It's a Tuesday afternoon in 1985, and Andy Grove is standing in his office at Intel headquarters in Santa Clara. Gordon Moore is sitting across the desk. The numbers are catastrophic. Japanese DRAM manufacturers Hitachi, NEC, Toshiba have driven Intel's memory chip margins to zero. 7 of 8 fabrication plants are bleeding money. 8,000 employees are about to lose their jobs. Intel, the company that invented the DRAM chip, that created the market, that once held 80% share, is on the verge of bankruptcy.
Grove turns to Moore and asks a question that will become the most famous sentence in the history of corporate strategy. If we got kicked out and the board brought in a new CEO, what do you think he would do?
Moore doesn't hesitate. He'd get us out of memories.
And then Grove does something that almost nobody talks about. He doesn't just nod and start planning. He stands up. He walks Moore to the building's revolving door. The two of them physically walk through it, step outside, stand there for a moment, and then turn around and walk back in. Grove looks at Moore and says, "Okay, what would the new guys do?" They enacted the metaphor. The old Intel walked out. The new Intel walked back in.
And from that moment, Intel was no longer a memory company.
Welcome back to Silicon Valley Strategy. I'm Myra D'Amico.
And I'm Travis Carlisle. This is episode 2. So that scene, the revolving door, the physical performance of killing your own identity, is one of the most consequential 5 minutes in corporate history. And today we're going deep on the company that made it necessary.
Today we're doing Intel, which is, I think this might be the single most important corporate strategy story in the history of the technology industry. Not the most dramatic, not the most emotionally resonant. But if you want to understand how a company survives a paradigm shift, how it deliberately kills its own core business and reinvents itself around a new one, this is the case study.
And it's not just the pivot. It's the fact that Intel then created one of the most durable competitive moats in the history of business, the x86 architecture, the Intel Inside campaign, the entire Wintel ecosystem. And then, decades later, watch that moat erode because they couldn't do the same thing again. They couldn't pivot a second time.
The arc of Intel is the arc of every great technology company. Build something brilliant, defend it ferociously, miss the next thing. The question is always, can you do it twice?
Intel couldn't. But the first time they did it, the DRAM to microprocessor pivot is still the gold standard for strategic self-disruption.
All right, trivia. And this one is genuinely surprising. Here's the question for listeners. Intel's first product was not a processor. It was a memory chip. What was Intel's first commercially successful product, and what near-bankruptcy moment forced the pivot to microprocessors?
This is one of those facts that every MBA student knows and that almost nobody outside business school appreciates for how dramatic it actually was.
If you're playing along, pause now. The answer, Intel's first hit was the 1103 DRAM chip released in 1970. It became the world's best-selling semiconductor. DRAM was Intel's identity. It was what they were. And then by 1984, Japanese manufacturers, Hitachi, NEC, Toshiba, backed by government subsidies and a willingness to price below cost, had driven Intel's DRAM market share from roughly 80% down to less than 5%. Intel's margins were gone. The company was hemorrhaging cash.
And the response, the revolving door walk between Grove and Moore, led to the most consequential corporate pivot of the 20th century. They shut down 7 of 8 DRAM fabrication plants, laid off a third of their workforce, and bet the entire company on microprocessors.
They didn't hedge. They didn't keep a small DRAM division just in case. They killed it completely. And that takes a kind of conviction that I think most leaders simply don't have.
It also takes the intellectual honesty to admit that the thing you built, the thing that made you, is no longer the thing that will save you.
That's the trivia. Intel's first love was memory. Memory nearly killed them. And the thing that saved them was the willingness to walk through a revolving door and come back as someone else. Let's set the stage. Intel is founded in 1968. What does the world look like?
So the critical context is that the semiconductor industry is now a decade old. The fair children have scattered. Noyce and Moore have left Fairchild and are starting Intel. The integrated circuit exists. The Apollo program is in full swing. Humans will land on the moon the following year. The defense customer is still the dominant buyer of semiconductors, but something is shifting. The commercial market is starting to matter.
And this is where the founding story of Intel is so different from Fairchild. Fairchild was eight guys with a general intention and 10 signed dollar bills. Intel is two of the most famous names in semiconductors, Robert Noyce and Gordon Moore, going to Arthur Rock with a one-page business plan and raising $2.5 million in 48 hours.
48 hours, one page, $2.5 million. That's the power of reputation. Noyce was, by 1968, the most famous technologist in America after maybe a handful of NASA astronauts. Moore had articulated what would become Moore's Law. Rock knew them from Fairchild. The fundraise was essentially, it's Noyce and Moore. Are you in? And everyone said yes.
Compare that to the Fairchild fundraise we talked about last episode. Kleiner writing a letter to his father's stockbroker. Now it's two phone calls and a check.
That's what a track record buys you.
But here's the thing that people miss about the founding of Intel. The plan was not microprocessors. The plan was memory chips. Noyce and Moore left Fairchild specifically to build better semiconductor memory. The processor came later, almost by accident.
The thing that's analytically interesting about Intel's founding is the talent density. They didn't just have Noyce and Moore. They hired Andy Grove, a Hungarian refugee who had survived the Nazi occupation of Budapest, fled the Soviet invasion in 1956, arrived in America barely speaking English, got a PhD in chemical engineering from Berkeley, and became the most operationally brilliant manager in Silicon Valley history. Grove was employee number three.
Put yourself in Andy Grove's shoes. You're 32 years old. You survived the Holocaust as a child. You survived the Hungarian Revolution. You came to a country where you knew nobody and didn't speak the language. And now Robert Noyce, the most famous man in the semiconductor industry, is asking you to help build a company. What do you say?
You say yes, and then you spend the next 30 years proving that operational excellence is a form of genius.
This is the part that kills me about the Grove story. The man is literally a war survivor, and he ends up running a chip company with the intensity of someone who knows what real danger looks like.
Because he does know.
The broader world context, 1968 is chaos, Vietnam, the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, student protests. But in Santa Clara, California, two men and their brilliant operations chief are sitting down to build a memory chip company. The contrast is surreal.
And the Japanese semiconductor industry is just beginning to emerge. MITAI, the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, is coordinating Japan's national technology strategy. Within 15 years, those Japanese companies will nearly destroy Intel. But in 1968, nobody in Santa Clara is worried about Japan. The enemy is other American semiconductor companies. The threat that will nearly kill Intel hasn't yet appeared on the horizon.
Intel's first product, the 1103 DRAM chip, ships in 1970 and becomes a sensation. It's the first commercially viable semiconductor memory device. Before the 1103, computers stored data using magnetic cores, tiny rings of ferrite threaded onto wire grids. Magnetic core memory worked, but it was expensive, bulky, and labor-intensive to manufacture. The 1103 replaced all of that with a single chip.
And within 2 years, the 1103 is the best-selling semiconductor in the world. Intel's revenue goes from essentially zero to meaningful in a matter of months. The company's identity is formed. We are a memory company. That's what we do.
And then something strange happens. In 1969, a Japanese calculator company called Busicom comes to Intel and asks them to design a set of 12 custom chips for a new calculator. The project is assigned to Ted Hoff, an Intel engineer, who looks at Busicom's design and thinks, this is insane. 12 custom chips for a calculator? There's got to be a simpler way.
Hoff's insight is one of the great what if moments in technology history. Instead of 12 specialized chips, he proposes a single general-purpose processor that can be programmed to perform different functions, one chip that can do the work of 12. This becomes the Intel 4004, the world's first commercial microprocessor, released in 1971.
And here's the part that makes me want to reach through time and shake somebody. Busicom owns the rights to the 4004. Intel designed it under contract, but Busicom is struggling financially, and Intel goes to them and offers to reduce the contract price in exchange for getting the chip rights back. Busicom agrees.
Intel buys back the rights to the microprocessor for $60,000.
Wait, say that number again.
$60,000, the rights to the microprocessor, $60,000.
That is the best deal in the history of the technology industry. Those rights became the foundation of a $400 billion company.
It might be. It's at least in the conversation with IBM's operating system deal, which we'll get to. $60,000 for the concept that every computer on Earth would eventually run on. Busicom sold the future of computing for the price of a modest house.
And nobody at Intel fully appreciated what they were holding either, right? The 4004 was seen as a curiosity.
Totally. 2,300 transistors. About 60,000 calculations per second. A clever solution to a specific problem, not the foundation of a new industry. Intel's current chips have billions of transistors and perform trillions of calculations, but the architecture, the fundamental concept of a general-purpose processor, traces back to that $60,000 buyback from a calculator company in Japan.
The entire lineage from a calculator contract.
And this is where Intel develops something that Hamilton Helmer would call counter-positioning, though nobody recognizes it at the time. Counter-positioning is when a new business model is so different from the incumbent's that the incumbent can't adopt it without damaging their existing business. Intel's microprocessor wasn't competing with DRAM. It was creating an entirely new category. The established memory companies, including Intel's own memory division, had no reason to pursue it. The processor business was tiny, weird, and irrelevant to the memory market, which meant Intel got a decade-long head start building something nobody else wanted to build.
Right. And that counterpositioning flips later, which is the tragic part. But for now, Intel has two businesses, memory chips, which are making real money, and microprocessors, which are interesting but small. For the next decade, these two businesses coexist inside the company. Memory is the core. Processors are the side project.
And then IBM calls.
It's 1980. IBM has decided to build a personal computer. They're in a panic because Apple is selling Apple IIs, and the market is growing fast, and IBM has nothing. So IBM assembles a team in Boca Raton, Florida, gives them a year, and tells them to build a PC using off-the-shelf components. No proprietary hardware, just get it done.
The Boca Raton team makes two decisions that reshape the entire technology industry. First, they choose Intel's 8088 processor as the CPU. Second, they choose Microsoft's MS-DOS as the operating system. Both of these are licensed, not built in-house. IBM doesn't own either one.
And critically, this is the part that changes everything. IBM uses an open architecture. The technical specifications are published. Anyone can build a compatible machine. IBM assumes that the IBM brand name will protect them.
They assume hardware is where the value is. They're exactly catastrophically wrong.
And you know what kills me? IBM had 15,000 lawyers on staff at the time. 15,000? And not one of them flagged the implications of publishing the architecture specs with non-exclusive component licenses.
15,000 lawyers, and none of them saw it coming.
That's going to be a theme this season. The smartest people in the room missing the most important thing in the room.
So let me actually trace the chain of consequences here, because I think it's the most elegant disaster in corporate history. In an open architecture, anyone can build a clone. Compaq reverse engineers the BIOS in 1982 and ships the first IBM-compatible PC. Then dozens of other manufacturers follow. Every single clone needs two things: an Intel-compatible processor and Microsoft's DOS. IBM's open architecture turns Intel and Microsoft into the only choke points in the entire PC ecosystem.
Every clone sold is a royalty check for Intel and Microsoft. IBM literally created the business models of its two most important suppliers. It's one of the great strategic blunders in corporate history.
And for Intel specifically, the IBM deal transforms the microprocessor from a side business into the foundation of a new computing paradigm. The x86 architecture, the instruction set that the 8088 uses, becomes the standard that every PC application is written for. And oh man, this is where the moat starts building. Not just any moat, switching costs that would last longer than most companies survive.
Explain what you mean by that.
So Helmer defines switching costs as the cost a customer incurs from switching to a competitor's product. For x86, those costs were staggering. Windows was built on x86. Every enterprise application, every developer tool, every compiler, every line of code that corporate America ran. To switch away from Intel's architecture didn't mean buying a different chip. It meant rewriting the entire software ecosystem.
Oh, here it is. So the chip itself is almost beside the point. The lock-in is the software layer on top of it.
Exactly. The architecture becomes the platform. And once the platform has decades of software written for it, the switching costs are functionally infinite. Nobody's going to rewrite Microsoft Office for a different instruction set just because some other chip is 15% faster. Those switching costs lasted for more than 30 years.
More than 30 years until ARM found the one market where the switching costs didn't apply because there was no legacy software to switch from.
But that's getting ahead of the story.
While the PC market is exploding, something terrible is happening to Intel's core business. Japanese semiconductor manufacturers, Hitachi, NEC, Toshiba, Fujitsu, have been building DRAM capacity with massive government subsidies from MIT-I. By the early 1980s, they're producing DRAM chips that are higher quality and lower cost than anything Intel can make.
And this is where the competitive dynamics become almost textbook. The Japanese manufacturers had access to enormous domestic consumer electronics markets that subsidized their semiconductor production. They could run their fabs at higher utilization rates, spread fixed costs across far more units, and price below Intel's cost structure. Intel invented this market. They were the original scale player. And within 15 years, they were the subscale competitor being priced out of their own game.
Which is wild, right? The company that created DRAM is now losing to companies that just did it bigger.
That's the thing about scale advantages. They're not permanent. They accrue to whoever has the largest production volume right now. When the Japanese manufacturers invested in capacity that exceeded Intel's, the advantage shifted. Intel's historical position was irrelevant. What mattered was current production volume.
If you run the math, the numbers are devastating. Intel's DRAM market share collapses from roughly 80% in the mid-1970s to less than 5% by 1984. Intel is losing $173 million a year on DRAM. The company is hemorrhaging cash and the memory division is the wound.
Which brings us to the conversation. 1985, Grove's office.
I love this part.
The question, if we got kicked out and the board brought in a new CEO, what would he do? The answer, exit memory. And then Grove stands up, walks more to the revolving door. They walk through it together, turn around, walk back in, and start being the new guys. That wasn't a figure of speech. They physically did it. Grove needed the act, the bodily sensation of leaving and returning, to make the psychological break feel real.
What gets me about this moment is the emotional weight of it. Grove isn't making a spreadsheet decision. He's asking himself and Moore to kill the thing they built, to admit that the company they founded is no longer the company it needs to be. That's not analysis, that's grief. It's a funeral for the identity of the company.
It is. And you know what? Most CEOs would have commissioned a study. Grove walked through a revolving door.
Literally.
And then they actually do it. They shut down 7 of 8 DRAM fabrication plants. They lay off 8,000 employees, roughly a third of Intel's entire workforce. They redirect every resource toward microprocessors.
Now, I want to push back on the idea that this was purely rational, because I think there's something irrational about it too. Most boards, most management teams would have tried to do both. Keep a small DRAM operation, hedge, diversify. The fact that Grove went all in, killed the thing entirely.
That's not just strategic clarity.
It's not. That's a personality trait. Grove was not a hedger. He was a person who had survived the Nazis and the Soviets. He understood existential threats in a way that most American executives simply didn't.
He could tell the difference between something that's merely uncomfortable and something that will actually kill you.
And the thing about the DRAM exit is that it's a perfect illustration of counterpositioning in reverse. When Intel first started building microprocessors, the memory incumbents couldn't respond because the processor business was too small and too different to justify the pivot. Now, Intel is the incumbent in memory, and the new business, processors is the thing that's too different from who they think they are. Grove's genius was recognizing that Intel needed to be the one that counterpositioned against itself. Don't wait for someone else to eat your lunch. Eat it yourself.
And then, the thing that turns Intel from a survivor into a colossus is the Intel Inside campaign. Launched in 1991, this is a B2B semiconductor company deciding to build a consumer brand.
Which was considered insane at the time, by the way. The semiconductor industry thought they lost their minds. You're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars telling grandmothers about microprocessors.
Hundreds of millions of dollars convincing ordinary people, people who have never thought about what processor is inside their computer, to care. The bong sound, the sticker on every PC, the cooperative advertising program where Intel pays PC manufacturers to put the Intel Inside logo on their machines.
And here's how this works as a competitive weapon. Intel was a supplier, a component maker, and suppliers are always vulnerable to their customers' purchasing power. The PC manufacturer could negotiate Intel down on price because the end consumer didn't care who made the chip. Intel Inside changed that equation entirely. It created pull-through demand that bypassed the PC manufacturer. Consumers started asking for Intel by name. PC manufacturers couldn't switch to a competitor's processor without losing customers. The brand became a moat.
They went over the customer's head directly to the customer's customer. That's a move you almost never see a component company pull off.
Think about how bold that is. Dolby did it later. Gore-Tex did it. Made with Unity. But Intel did it first, and at a scale that nobody had attempted.
And then 3 years into Intel Inside, the brand gets stress tested in the worst possible way. The Pentium FDIV bug, 1994.
Oh, this is a wild story.
So, FDIV, as in floating point division. A mathematics professor named Thomas Nicely at Lynchburg College in Virginia is running number theory computations, and he notices that his Pentium processor is producing incorrect results for certain division operations. Small errors, but real ones. He can't figure out what's wrong. He checks his code, checks his data, checks everything. Eventually, he narrows it down to the chip itself.
And here's what makes this different from every previous hardware bug in history. Nicely doesn't call Intel. He doesn't write a letter. He posts his findings to a Usenet newsgroup on the internet in 1994.
Right. And this is, I think people don't fully appreciate how early this was. The web barely exists, but the internet does, and the academic and technical community is online, and Nicely's post spreads. It hits comp.cessusintel, then it hits the mainstream tech press, then CNN picks it up. The late-night talk shows start making jokes about it.
Wait, what was Intel's initial response?
This is the part that's painful. Intel's initial response is to minimize it. They say the bug affects only 1 in 9 billion calculations. They offer to replace chips, but only for customers who can demonstrate that they're personally affected by the specific class of errors.
Oh no.
Prove you're affected and we'll help you. That's the policy.
For a company that just spent hundreds of millions of dollars telling consumers to trust the name on the sticker.
Exactly. And the backlash is ferocious. This is the first internet amplified brand crisis in history. The fury spreads faster than Intel expects. IBM announces it will stop shipping Pentium-based PCs. Intel is eventually forced to offer a no-questions-asked replacement for every Pentium chip sold. The cost? $475
million. $475
million.
Because they tried to argue statistics with consumers they'd trained to care about the brand.
Grove's lesson, which he wrote about extensively, you can't solve a trust problem with a technical argument. Intel was right that the bug affected almost nobody in practice, and it did not matter. Not even a little.
Because you built the brand. You told consumers to trust the name on the sticker. And then, when the sticker was wrong, you said, well, technically, it's only wrong 1 in 9 billion times. You can't have the brand without the accountability. That's the deal.
Trust is binary. You either have it or you don't. And once it's gone, no amount of statistical analysis will bring it back.
There's something poetic about the fact that Intel's greatest marketing achievement, Intel Inside, is exactly what made the FDIV bug a crisis instead of a footnote. Without the brand, nobody outside a handful of mathematicians would have cared, but Intel had spent years making ordinary people care about their processor, and ordinary people do not want to hear about 1 in 9 billion error rates.
You reap what you sow in both directions.
So let's talk about what happened after Intel survived the DRAM crisis and built this incredible competitive position. Because the second half of the Intel story is about watching one of the greatest collections of competitive advantages in business history slowly erode.
For 3 decades after the DRAM pivot, Intel had something extraordinary in semiconductor manufacturing: their ability to produce chips at ever smaller geometries to stay on the leading edge of Moore's Law was unmatched. Nobody could build transistors as small, as dense, as power efficient as Intel. And this process leadership was the foundation of everything else. The switching costs from x86, the brand from Intel Inside, all of it rested on the assumption that Intel's chips were the best manufactured chips in the world.
And then TSMC passed them.
And then TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, a foundry that manufactures chips for other companies, caught up to and then surpassed Intel's manufacturing process in the 2010s. When that happened, the entire strategic logic of Intel's integrated model started to collapse.
Because Intel was an IDM, an integrated device manufacturer. They designed chips and manufactured them in their own fabs. The alternative model, a fabless, was to design chips and outsource manufacturing to TSMC.
For decades, Intel's process leadership made the IDM model superior. But the moment TSMC's process became equal or better, the fabless model won. Because fabless companies like NVIDIA and AMD could access TSMC's manufacturing and focus entirely on design innovation. Intel was now paying the enormous overhead of running its own fabs without the process advantage that justified it.
And that's the tragedy of Intel. They did the walk out the door test once, and it saved the company. They needed to do it again, to confront the fact that their manufacturing model was no longer competitive, and they couldn't.
Or at least not fast enough. Pat Gelsinger, who became Intel's CEO in 2021, tried with Intel Foundry Services and the IDM 2.0 strategy. But by then, TSMC had a decade head start as a foundry, and NVIDIA had captured the AI chip market. The window for the second pivot may have already closed.
Every single episode so far, Shockley's genius destroyed Shockley. Fairchild's talent enriched everyone but Fairchild. Intel's manufacturing prowess trapped Intel.
The biggest strength becomes the biggest weakness. We keep seeing this pattern.
And if this kind of deep dive analysis is your thing, you should check out our online course at svsstrategy.xyz. There's actually a mystery company simulation for this era where you have to make the DRAM exit decision yourself before finding out it's Intel. Plus AI roleplay scenarios, a 70-year interactive timeline, and quizzes on every episode. That's SV, short for Silicon Valley, strategy.xyz.
Supstrategy.xyz. It's a great companion to the show. Let me zoom out on Grove's framework here because I think it ties the whole story together. Strategic inflection points from his 1996 book, Only the Paranoid Survive.
And we've been seeing this concept play out in real time through the whole episode, but let's name it explicitly.
Right. A strategic inflection point is a 10x change in one of the forces affecting your business. A 10x change in competition, technology, customer behavior, supplier dynamics, regulation, or complementary products. And the critical insight, the thing that makes it more than just a buzzword, is that strategic inflection points are visible in qualitative signals before they appear in quantitative ones.
Say more about that.
Grove noticed that Intel's best engineers were migrating from the memory division to the microprocessor division before the revenue numbers showed that memory was dying. The talent was voting with its feet. The P&L hadn't caught up yet.
So the signal precedes the data.
Always. The companies that navigate inflection points successfully are the ones that read the qualitative signals and act before the quantitative confirmation arrives. By the time the data confirms the inflection point, you're already late.
Now I want to push back a little because I think the framework has a blind spot. It's great for identifying threats to your existing business, but it's less useful for identifying entirely new opportunities that don't map onto your current competitive landscape. Intel saw the threat from Japanese DRAM because it was happening to them directly. they didn't see the threat from ARM and mobile because mobile wasn't their market.
That's a fair critique. The framework is defensive, not offensive. It tells you when to exit. It doesn't tell you what to enter.
Which is a pretty big blind spot.
It is. But a defensive tool that actually works is still more than most companies have. And the other big lesson here is about vertical integration. Intel's model of designing and manufacturing its own chips was unambiguously superior for decades. But it had a hidden assumption that their manufacturing process would remain at or near the state of the art.
The moment TSMC's process caught Intel's and then passed it, the IDM model became a liability. Intel was paying the enormous fixed costs of running leading-edge fabs without the leading-edge performance that justified those costs.
So the framework is vertical integration is a power when you're the best at every layer of the stack. It becomes a trap when someone else becomes better at one of those layers because you can't easily disaggregate.
And it connects directly to the walk-out-the-door test. If a new CEO walked into Intel in 2015 and asked, what would they do? The answer might have been stop trying to be a manufacturer and become a fabless design company. But Intel's identity was so intertwined with its fabs that the question was nearly impossible to ask, let alone answer. So what does a founder take from the Intel story today?
I want to start with the walk out the door test, because I think it's the most practically useful framework in this entire course. And the fact that Grove and Moore physically did it, actually walked through that revolving door and came back, tells you something about the psychological weight of what they were doing. The reason the test works is that it creates cognitive distance from sunk costs. When you're inside a company, your identity is intertwined with the decisions you've already made. You built the DRAM division, you hired the team, you spent a decade becoming the best in the world at memory. Killing that is killing a part of yourself. The test bypasses all of that emotional overhead by asking, what would a stranger do? A stranger has no sunk costs. A stranger has no identity tied to the old strategy. A stranger just looks at the situation as it is.
But here's the thing I keep thinking about. The test worked once at Intel. It didn't work a second time. And I think the reason is that the test requires you to be honest about what you see when you come back through the door. In 1985, Grove saw the DRAM numbers, and they were unambiguous. In 2010, the mobile numbers were also unambiguous. Smartphones were growing at 30% per year, and Intel had essentially no presence. But Intel's processor business was still enormously profitable. It's easy to be honest about a burning building. It's hard to be honest about a building that's merely on the wrong street.
That's a great point. The test fails when your current business is still profitable enough to mask the strategic decay. Grove called that the valley of death, the period between when a strategic inflection point is identifiable and when the financial consequences become undeniable. Most companies die in that valley because they mistake current profitability for strategic health.
And the Intel Inside campaign, I think there's a broader lesson there for any company that operates behind a customer-facing brand. If you're a supplier, a component maker, an infrastructure company, you're vulnerable to your customer's purchasing power. Intel Inside was a way of going over the customer's head, directly to the end user, and creating demand that the customer couldn't ignore. That playbook has been replicated. Dolby, Gore-Tex, made with Unity. The pattern is build a brand that the consumer recognizes so that your OEM customer can't swap you out without losing demand.
The FDIV bug lesson is the inverse. If you build a consumer brand as a component company, you also inherit consumer expectations around trust and transparency. Intel got the upside of Intel Inside, brand recognition, pricing power, pull-through demand. And then they got the downside. When the Pentium bug hit, consumers held Intel to a consumer standard, not a B2B standard. The first internet-amplified brand crisis in history, and it happened to a chip company. You can't have the brand without the accountability.
Takeaways, you first.
My first takeaway, and this is the framework from this episode, is the strategic inflection point. Grove defined it as a 10x change in one of the competitive forces affecting your business. And the key insight is that qualitative signals always precede quantitative confirmation. Your best engineers leave the legacy division before the revenue declines. Your smartest customers start asking about alternatives before they actually switch. The inflection point is visible in behavior before it's visible in spreadsheets. The companies that survive are the ones that read behavior, not just numbers.
And the corollary to that, by the time the data confirms the inflection point, you're already in the valley of death. The window for action is when the signals are ambiguous and the P&L still looks fine. That's also, of course, the moment when it's hardest to act because you look crazy. Grove looked crazy killing Dram when it was still Intel's identity. He was right.
My second takeaway is about the nature of competitive advantage over time. Intel had three distinct moats across its history: DRAM scale, x86 switching costs, and process technology leadership. Each one was real. Each one was durable for a period, and each one eventually eroded. DRAM scale was lost to the Japanese. x86 switching costs were bypassed by ARM and mobile. Process leadership was surpassed by TSMC. The lesson isn't that moats don't matter. They do. They bought Intel decades of dominance. The lesson is that no moat is permanent. The question isn't, do we have a moat? But what's the half-life of our moat, and what are we building to replace it when it decays?
That's good. My first takeaway is personal, and it's about Andy Grove. I keep thinking about what it means that the man who saved Intel was a refugee. Grove survived the Nazis as a child in Budapest. He survived the Soviet invasion of Hungary in 1956. He arrived in the United States at age 20, barely speaking English. And then he ran one of the most important companies in the world with a kind of ruthless operational clarity that nobody else in Silicon Valley could match. I think the refugee experience isn't incidental to his management style. When you've survived genuine existential threats, not metaphorical ones, not we might miss our quarterly numbers threats, but actual life and death threats, you develop an instinct for when something is truly dangerous versus when it's merely uncomfortable. Grove could tell the difference. Most executives can't.
And the $60,000 buyback from Busicom. I keep coming back to that. The entire microprocessor industry, the entire PC revolution, the entire foundation of Intel's $400 billion market cap traces back to a deal where a struggling Japanese calculator company sold the rights to a chip design for the price of a modest house. The lesson there is about recognizing optionality. Intel didn't know what the 4004 would become. Nobody did, but they had the instinct to acquire the rights, even when the asset seemed like a curiosity. The best strategic moves often look trivial at the time.
My second takeaway is about what Intel missed: mobile, AI, the two biggest computing paradigm shifts of the 21st century, and Intel wasn't a meaningful player in either one. ARM's low-power architecture won mobile because smartphones needed battery life more than raw performance, and Intel's x86 was optimized for performance, not power efficiency. NVIDIA's CUDA platform won AI because NVIDIA invested in parallel computing capability years before anyone realized that neural network training was a massively parallel problem that GPUs were ideally suited for. Intel saw both of these shifts happening and couldn't respond. And I think the reason connects to the framework. The strategic inflection point was visible, but Intel's identity made the response impossible. They could accept stop making memory. They couldn't accept stop making x86 processors or stop running your own fabs. The second pivot was too far from home. Before we go, if you want to dig deeper on strategic inflection points, the online course at svsstrategy.x, YZ has a 7-powers analysis tool where you can map out any company's competitive advantages, plus podcast transcripts with section navigation so you can jump right to the frameworks. That's svstrategy.xyz.
svsstrategy.xyz. All right. Next time on the show, Apple. Part 1, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. The personal computer revolution, the 1984 Super Bowl ad, the ouster, the wilderness years, and the question that haunts the entire story: what happens when the product visionary and the engineering genius can't coexist in the same company?
That's going to be emotional.
Bring tissues.
We'll see you then.